Welcome to Wrap'em Focus, a podcast devoted to exploring the provocative and impactful aspects of the research published in Regional Anesthesia and Pain Medicine. Here, we'll make sure to discuss and debate the findings that matter most for clinicians, patients, and policymakers. I'm Brian Seitz, Editor-in-Chief. I am an anesthesiologist and professor at Dartmouth Hitchcock Medical Center. At Wrap'em, we believe well-done pain medicine improves health and well-being. I'll work to keep the discussion relevant and factual. Thanks for joining us. Let's get started. There has been significant controversy around the value of fascial plane blocks in acute pain medicine. Proponents argue that value can be found in opioid reduction and improvement in pain scores. Critics argue that the effect size tends to be very small, that amounting to even placebo, and time limited. To complicate matters even further, there are new fascial plane blocks emerging yearly, each being compared to one another. Given this ongoing debate, we are elated to support the work of Dr. Jens Borglum and colleagues. Today, we're joined by Dr. Jens Borglum. Dr. Borglum is a consultant anesthetist, clinical research associate professor, head of research at Zealand University Hospital, University of Copenhagen, Denmark. His main interests are ultrasound-guided nerve blocks, and he is a prolific researcher and contributor to Wrap'em. He is an amazing editor, providing his clinical and research insights to help with the peer review process. Jens, thank you so much for joining us today.
Brian, thank you very much for inviting me. I'm very proud.
Jens was the senior author in a fascinating study examining the role of QL blocks in providing analgesia for laparoscopic hemicolectomy. He conducted a randomized, controlled, double-blinded trial where 69 patients were randomized to receive an anterior quadratus lumborum block with ropivacaine, 0.375%, 30 mLs on each side, or isotonic saline, the placebo. The primary outcome measure was total opioid consumption during the first 24 hours post-surgery. So, Jens, to start things off, can you share with the listeners your thoughts on mechanistically how QL blocks might provide analgesia? And this might be a good time to just briefly summarize the three main types in the new nomenclature.
Absolutely. The first QL block described was in, mentioned, was in 2007. It was then called the QL1 block. And today this is called the lateral QL block. A little later, the same author, Dr. Rafael Blanco, described the QL2 block, now called the posterior QL block. And we, in 2013, described the QLB, QL block 3, which is now called the anterior QL block. So the first QL block, which is now called the lateral QL block, is placed on the anterior surface of the QL muscle just below the aponeurosis of the transversus abdominis muscle. The local anesthetic injected here will spread across the anterior surface of the QL muscle and will anesthetize the iliointegral, iliohypogastric, and sometimes very often also the lateral femoral cutaneous nerve. This means it will give coverage or anesthesia to the area around T12 L1. Now, Rafael Blanco, Dr. Rafael Blanco, now moved more posterior with his technique to inject into the, which he described, into the torcolumbar fascia at the lateral and posterior surface of the QL muscle. How that works is still an enigma to many. Dr. Rafael Blanco has tested the hypothesis that he would then inject into the torcolumbar fascia to block the sympathetic nerve fibers inside this fascia. It has not been tested further than this hypothesis. Now, when we began doing our transmuscular cradatus lumborum block, which is now called the enter a QL block is to inject between the crowdoutid lumborum muscle and the psoas major muscle and posterior to the fascia covering the inside of the abdomen. Now, we have shown in cadaveric study published in Anesthesia and Analgesia in 2014 that this local anesthetic or dye would spread cranially and into the thoracic pervertebral space to dye the anterior rami and also the communicating rami to the sympathetic trunk. Also the sympathetic trunk itself, meaning that our anterior QL block would probably provide analgesia from those nerves from TH8 to TH12, maybe also L1, and also to provide blockage of the sympathetic trunk, meaning that we could probably alleviate visceral pain as well as somatic sensory pain.
Jens, that's a great overview. Let me just interject one question here. So if I hear you correctly, in terms of abdominal surgery, the mechanism of paravertebral spread is likely really the only major mechanism that would, and I don't want to put words in your mouth, but mechanism that would actually contribute to analgesia, because the QL muscle is quite, you know, distal, and so you're really going to need that proximal spread to some meaningful area to get abdominal coverage, as opposed to, like, I would say, you know, inguinal or leg coverage.
Absolutely, that was the whole idea and our goal. We believed that we could actually perform a thoracic paravertebral block in the lumbar region with where the pleura was not as close, so we could achieve this cranial spread of the local anesthetic into the thoracic paravertebral space to achieve what we would have gotten anyhow if we would have used a thoracic paravertebral block.
That's a very interesting concept, and it kind of makes sense anatomically. In terms of the background idea for the study, did you have a specific clinical experience that influenced you, such as poor control of analgesia after the surgery, or was this more just the kind of pursuit of alternatives to current, let's say, like, you know, ERAS standards?
That's a very good question. If I have to say, and I hope I do not mention use too many words, but we tried this block first in patients undergoing percutaneous nephrolithotomy, then in patients undergoing hand-assisted laparoscopic total nephrectomy, and also in patients undergoing robotic-assisted heminephrectomies, and in addition also elective cesarean section patients. So in all of these randomized controlled clinical studies actually published in Rabin, we found a significant reduction in post-operative opioid. So our hypothesis was that we could do that, we could achieve the same, hopefully the same positive effect in patients undergoing laparoscopic hemicolectomy suffering from cancer. We didn't. Much to our surprise, we found absolutely no significant reduction in opioid pain scores, early ambulation, or anything. So that was a huge surprise for us.
And we'll definitely come back to that in just a second. And I think that's actually a good segue into my next question. And this is a little bit of a provocative question, but that's what we do here on Wrap and Focus. We ask the tough questions. So what would you say to the skeptic that might believe in the setting of ERAS, enhanced recovery after surgery, and all the protocols, for minimally invasive surgery, that is going to be extremely difficult to identify a clinically meaningful signal. In other words, we've gotten so good at the surgical technique and the use of multimodal therapies, polypharmacy, non-opioid therapies, that patients do well independent of the nerve block.
Absolutely, Brian. As I see it, I would have loved to have been conducting my studies 20 years ago, because in those days, exactly, in those days, the analgesic regimes, the multimodal analgesic regimes, were not as good as they are today. One thing I have to mention for sure is the fact that in many, at least in Scandinavia, for many surgeries, it is a given thing that patients are given 16 or 24 milligrams of dexamethasone as a pre-anesthetic regime. I mean, and we would never have discussed that 20 years ago. That was a no-go. We would never have given that amount of steroids to any patients. But they do today. And I believe that has been a major advantage in this multimodal analgesic regimes, that they do that. And as I understand it, they haven't found any negative side effects. There's no greater infection rate. There's no any adverse events from this. The one thing, though, is that I have to say is that with cancer patients, many of the cancer surgeons are reluctant to use this amount of dexamethasone. So maybe in this respect, our contribution with the local anesthetic nerve blocks might be beneficial.
Right, and actually, you know, those are great points, Jens. Thank you. And I, to echo the words of Steve Cohen, one of our executive editors and prolific researchers in the chronic pain area, steroids work on every type of pain. Nociceptive pain, neuropathic pain, chronic pain, acute pain, et cetera, et cetera. So you're right. I mean, if there's an area where steroids are used less, that might be a target-rich environment to assess the efficacy of some of these interventions. So those are really, really great points. In terms of your findings, your main findings, both your primary and outcome metrics, do you mind summarizing some of the key takeaways for the listeners?
Yeah, absolutely. If it's allowable, I would say that we did find very positive effects with kidney surgery and elective cesarean sections. We did not, and we published that negative results in Rabin. We did not find the same effects at all in laparoscopic hysterectomy and laparoscopic hemicolectomy, which surprised us. We believed we had found the new epidural, so and we were surprised not to find any effect, because the reason we used that was when the patients having undergone laparoscopic hysterectomy or laparoscopic hemicolectomy, not in any studies, but prior to the studies, were suffering from pain despite having been treated with oxycodone or morphine for emergence. When they suffer from pain in the recovery area, we gave them that block and it alleviated the pain, and to some degree at least. And so our hypothesis was that we were actually very sure that we would get the same positive results again, but we didn't.
And I think that for their listeners and researchers who are considering submitting their work to RAPM, and I hope everybody is always thinking about that. We support publishing negative studies. We think they're critical. And we also think that there is definitely a publication bias in general in the medical literature. So we encourage you strongly to consider our journal when you have a correctly done, correctly powered negative study.
Just after we published in Rappen this study by one of my PhD students and me, another group from in Europe, in Belgium, in a very prestigious university, Leuven University, had undergone the same study using the anterior QL block for exactly the same patients, the laparoscopic hemicolectomies. And I have not seen the results yet, but I, from personal communication with the main author, I know that they had the same disappointing results as we had with laparoscopic hemicolectomy. And why that is so, it is why this is the outcome. It's very difficult for us in Denmark or Copenhagen and in Leuven in Belgium to fully be able to explain. We can't really. We have to report it, and I think it's very interesting and very important that it gets out, not being hidden away.
And eventually, you know, in terms of reproducibility, meta-analyses and systematic reviews are always kind of considered the pinnacle of evidence-based medicine, and this would contribute to that type of research. So it's important to have all of the studies out there. So, you know, hats off to you. And also hats off to you for staying positive emotionally, even though there's a negative study. Now, I wanted to touch on this topic of minimally significant differences in an outcome that are considered clinically relevant. And there's a lot of complexity in this topic. And Brian Ilfeld at the last spring ASRA meeting got into this, and it gets, you know, really complicated when you're talking about minimal differences that are important to individuals versus groups. And there's a statistical complexity there. But I don't want to get into the weeds here. The concept is there's some signal, some level of difference that would potentially be clinically significant in the sense that it would link up with something that is important, whether it's a length of stay, whether it is cost, patient experience, or something like that. And often we see researchers pre-specify that when they're doing their research. Like for instance, the researcher will say, "I believe that a difference of 3 on the pain score of 0 to 10 is clinically significant. There would be a justification for that." You didn't do that. And I'm just kind of curious, is that something you're thinking about doing in the future, or what are your thoughts on that topic in general?
That's a very important question. Of course, you design all the time your study, your randomized controlled trial, according to your primary outcome. That's where you make your power analysis, and that's decide how many patients you want to include. I am probably one of those researchers that likes to have also secondary outcome measures there, because those secondary outcome measures are hypothesis generating. And I like them because I know you cannot say that this will save now our study because the primary results, the primary outcomes were not significant. But I think it is important to have the secondary outcomes to be able to design newer studies. To say, okay, maybe we went into the wrong direction in the first place. We will now redirect our studies according to those secondary outcomes. So I believe that is important. But to answer you specifically, Brian, as a NRS score, NRS pain scores, I would say that a patient in the recovery area receiving a block when the pain score after surgery was 8, and I reduced that to 6 after a block, I would not say that was very important. I generally believe that a block or a block procedure should actually reduce the pain score to such a degree that the nurses in recovery are able to discharge the patients to the wards. If not, we can only supplement a little bit. But each department must ask himself how much energy and economy would we put into this area of block area, ability to block the patients in the correct way. Because if you use too much time and energy and money in something that doesn't work, it is not worthwhile.
Well, that's a great point. And I think as we're discussing this topic, it occurred to me that one of the challenges in this type of research in a contemporary sense is the fact that the trends in opioid utilization, if you're looking at opioid as an outcome metric, are really declining from a societal standpoint, the use of opioids, independent of anything else. You mentioned 20 years ago, at least in the United States, which is obviously a little bit different than Europe, really massive amounts of opioids were being used. And that led to all sorts of problems. But if you're studying opioid reduction therapies, it's probably a lot easier to show a signal if a lot of opioids are being used as opposed to starting out very small amounts. And this came up in another study that was published in RAPM, where there was some confusion about the primary outcome metrics. There was a switch after registration because they realized that opioids were just not being prescribed, and that really can't be the outcome metric for this particular study, which we don't need to go into detail about. But conceptually, I just think opioids are dropping as a trend, and that makes things a little more tricky when that's the primary outcome metric. Now, I wanted to digress for a moment and talk a little bit about visceral analgesia versus somatic analgesia. And this is, as you know, a controversial topic when pro-fascial plane block advocates are debating with traditionalists, I'll call them, epidural, paravertebral. Now, you've already mentioned you think that the anterior approach is likely working via a paravertebral mechanism. But let's just say for the sake of argument, for this discussion, that the QL blocks or the other types of QL blocks are not working through the paravertebral mechanism. How important is the need to cover visceral analgesia for abdominal surgery postoperatively, in your opinion?
I think it's pretty important, and that was actually what made us go further on from 2012 and further on. It was really an idea or a goal, a holy grail to try to find something that could replace the epidural, because we know what the epidural does. And we know also that epidural has some negative side effects or negative events. So that was basically because I was an avid tap block fan in from 2008 to 2012. I still am in some cases, but I believe that if you are conducted intra-abdominal or retroperitoneal surgery, where you are touching the organs and when you are manipulating the organs, then it is also important to get those to block those visceral pain afferents. So I think that is important, and I probably will not go back to the tap blocks because I now feel that I'm so confident with the anterior QL block that and so are my junior colleagues, that we believe we can do it pretty easily and without any harm or any pain for the patient.
And this is jumping ahead a little bit, but and please feel free to come back to your line of thought. But you're confident with the QL blocks, and I was curious to get your thoughts on the fact that a lot of people might not think the QL blocks are as simple as a tap block. And so how would you, what would be your recommendation in terms of you know, like future activities of those people? Should they, do you think that the QL block, because the way you do it is better than the TAP block, or how would you, what would be your recommendations?
Having had those experience with the negative results we've had with laparoscopic hysterectomy and laparoscopic hemicolectomy, I would once again urge to say that if you want to use a block technique for any kind of surgery, you have to examine that individually for that kind of surgery. We cannot extrapolate from elective cesarean section to laparoscopic hemicolectomy. We have to evaluate that. That takes a lot of time, a lot of effort, and a lot of scientific grievance. But I think it's very necessary that we do that. It's a different thing, I believe, if you're dealing with acute pain in recovery, because then you are faced with the fact that should we treat the patient with a massive amount of oxycodone or morphine or sulfentanil or fentanyl, or should we try at least, could we alleviate the pain with a simple block procedure? And I think if you find that you can actually, in randomized controlled trials, block the patients preoperatively and get a good results, then I think we should stick with that. But when you have examined it correctly with the randomized controlled trials to say that we actually found no difference, then it is only rescue analgesia you should support. And I know it's a lot of hard work. It's a lot of difficulty for us anesthesiologists, but we have to do it.
I agree 100%. And just so the listeners are clear, when I ask this question, the idea here is that the visceral pain pathways are anatomically different than the somatic pain pathways. And so when we do something like a TAP lock, or even for that matter, local infiltration, you're basically covering skin, subcutaneous tissue, maybe some of the fascia, that kind of stuff. Where the visceral pathways are involved with organs, peritoneum, so things like abdominal distension, swelling, that type of pain would be covered by the visceral pathways and obviously blocking them. So an epidural is a kind of the gold standard, because that gets complete coverage of both visceral and somatic pathways. And I know that's Andre Bozart, that's a big topic for him. And I've had some really fun discussions with him about the distinctions between those two pathways. In terms of other comments or thoughts about your study, Jens, do you want to have like kind of any other comments? And feel free to just kind of free talk.
Thank you very much, because that's my bread and butter. So we want, every time my PhD students and I are out there at the ESRA or ASRA congresses, we are asked basically three questions. One is, we believe that this block, the anterior cure block, is very close to the lumbar plexus. Do you affect the quadriceps femoris so you will hinder ambulation? That's question number one. Question number two is, that's an awful lot of ribavecin that you're using. What are your thoughts about local systemic LAST syndrome? That's number two. And the third is it difficult? Is it dangerous? Because this is a deep block. So to answer that, we have just finalized two studies studying plasma ribavecin concentrations following anterior QL blocks with this dosage. And we will submit that to Rappen shortly. We don't know how that will go, but we will see. And second is, in the same line of healthy young volunteers, we have investigated very thoroughly, directly looking at cordyceps strengths following QL blocks, and we will publish that also. And third, is it dangerous? To this has always been a key point for me, because when I perform an epidural, which I do a lot of the time for our mothers giving birth, and I place an obstetric epidural, I do this blindly into an area where I only have tactile information and nothing else. I believe that most of the time this goes very well and I do no harm. However, I think that our way of doing a ultrasound-guided QL block, the anterior QL block, is very safe. You can see where the needle goes. You can see that the local anesthetic assembles where that is placed. In my belief, that is a safe approach. But so I hope, Brian, that is an answer to some of your questions. We will try to, for the first two questions. We have new data coming out for you very soon. But the perspective that the QL block might be more dangerous than epidural, I don't know.
No, those are great points. And to hear the opinion of someone who's a prolific researcher and clinician kind of is the complete picture. So we really appreciate your insight. So I think it's probably fair to say that more work is needed to understand how QL blocks fit into ERAS surgery, specifically in the contemporary era. What do you see as the next best steps for future research?
I would actually like to combine a blockage of the sacral roots as well as the sympathetic roots. I've had a talk with a very well-known Professor Pia Lundqvist, who is also an author in Rappen, about how to achieve that in the best and most easy way. Maybe what we are investigating now is trying to use a blockage via the sacral hiatus. Basically, this is an epidural, but a single-shot epidural. And combine that with some kind of abdominal wall block. It could be the anterior QL block. It could be a parietal block. And that is for the where we have some problems with our patients undergoing a major surgery with robotic-assisted total prostatectomy. And those patients are suffering from pain in the bladder where our anterior QL block cannot help. But if you have an injection into the through the sacral hiatus, which will cover those parasympathetic pathways, we might achieve good results. The same goes actually with those laparoscopic hysterectomies, because if you remember from our earlier talk, that we found that we had no effect of the anterior QL block for a laparoscopic hysterectomy, because what the surgeons does is that they perform a surgery on the vault of the vagina, which is not covered by the sympathetic fibers or the somatosensory fibers, but called by the parasympathetic fibers. So they actually cut open the vaginal vault, close it again after they have extracted the uterus. So I believe that we want to pursue that with an ultrasound-guided block through the sacral hiatus, combining that with another kind of abdominal wall block. So this is where our surgery will now go.
That's fantastic. And that's what this whole process is about. It's iterative. It is idea building. It's confirmation. So that's kind of how it all works. So that's super exciting to hear that. So I think that pretty much wraps stuff up. And so, Dr. Borglum, it's been a real privilege to speak to you today. I want to thank you for sharing all of your insight on this topic with us and regional anesthesia, because you're such a gifted researcher and clinician. And of course, thanks to everyone who listened in.
Thank you for listening to the Rapham Focus podcast. Original music and production are done by Dan Langa. More information can be found at www.danlanga.com. We hope you'll join us in the future for more discussions with authors published in the Rapham Journal, and you can visit us at www.rapham.org.